This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
It's from the teachings of Zen Master Yukui, a poem on Zen meditation. Once the layered gates are shattered, any place is a place of tranquility. Once the mind becomes unattached to things, all things become pure. In moments of leisure, I sit upright in the shade of the pine tree, watching as the toad in the moon slowly rises to hover in the east. When one freely speaks of the Dharma, the heavenly flowers fall. When one deliberates and debates, one is confused by things. With the right opportunity and good fortune, nothing is impossible. Knocking on emptiness, extracting the marrow, becomes a way of life. How wonderfully sublime to discuss mysteries layered like clouds. It's truly rare to meet someone who can be called a kindred soul. The red stove blazes forth with an extraordinary determination, as if possessed the karmic power to turn the Dharma wheel. This toiling life, disordered and confused by lust, greed, and anger. But when the mind flower suddenly opens, the world becomes spring. Melting snow to boil water for tea, I while away the entire day, feeling inside as vast and expansive as the icy cold moon above. So Master Yikui was a 17th century Zen master. She was, you know, a couple weeks ago I gave a talk on Jingang, and another Zen master in China around the same time. And Yikui was a disciple of Jingang, one of seven disciples. And she said that she was a precocious, intelligent child, young girl, and that she mastered the sort of the skills of her time, sewing, embroidery, but also painting, poetry. She married young, as was the custom, and according to reports, had a happy marriage. It's nice to hear that. Until her husband died at an early age. So leaving her alone at the age of young age of 23. And so at that point, having lived one life, she, and I presume without children, doesn't mention that, she took to her room after her husband's death, and she remained in solitude for some extended period of time, eating a minimal, simple diet, and engaging in Nembutsu, the Pure Land practice, of reciting the name of Amitabha Buddha. And at some later point, she became interested in Chan, and in particular in meditation. And so she went to study with Master Jingang at her monastery, which was called Crouching Lion Convent. And she studied with her and finished her training and became one of her heirs, a teacher in her own right. And then she moved into a little hermitage. So once again, she returned to solitude. So perhaps that was an affinity with her. She had affinity for solitude. So she moved into a little hermitage on the side of a river that her brother built for her. Thank you, brother. And that was named the Cloister of Investigating commonality. And doesn't exactly roll off the tongue. Maybe it did in original language. And this hermitage, it seems, quickly developed into a large establishment. It's a very brief bio. As she attracted disciples. And so she taught, and this is, there are many records of teachers essentially going off and teaching alone or just practicing alone, living alone, and then people coming, disciples coming to seek them out and staying with them, and so a monastery is born. And so she did that and seemed to be quite happy doing that until Xingang, as I mentioned, had died, and her successor, Yingang, who was, of course, one of Yikui's Dharma sisters, who had taken over the abbess's role, it said fell ill from exhaustion and overwork. Oh, well. Have to keep our eye out for that. And so when she died, Yikui was designated by her Dharma sister as her successor. And so she went and served in that way for 6 years, and then finally was able to move back to her beloved hermitage where she died in 1679. So she was about 54. And she wrote, really her teachings are recorded in her poems. But it's interesting how often that, I mean, you know, sometimes people will call up and they'll say, "Hi, I'm interested in becoming a Zen teacher. What do I need to do?" That usually doesn't really go anywhere. Or at least not here, or at least they're not sane. You know, it's interesting how people, you know, most people come here to practice, to, in a sense, enter into their own solitude, to take up their own question of life and death. And then as we stay and engage, and, you know, if we continue and you know, develop our spiritual practice within this place or within this Sangha, then it's natural and inevitable and important, really, that everyone takes on responsibility, as we do in the very beginning. We take on responsibility as soon as we arrive. But that would continue, and that initial yearning or that initial impulse for solitude and quiet and solitary practice can evolve into something quite different than the person assumed. And yet that initial yearning is still important. It's still there. I know it is for me. And so then how that gets attended to, taken care of, protected, nurtured, continued to be developed within a vibrant living community and responsibilities. It's like the identity of relative and absolute. It's like the many streams moving into one ocean. It's learning how to integrate the one with the many, inside with the outside, and keep both aspects alive and healthy and serving others and oneself. You know, the emphasis on the Bodhisattva and the Bodhicitta to alleviate suffering of all beings is so important, and there's such an emphasis in the teachings on serving others, alleviating the suffering of others, of placing others before ourselves. And I hear that as, one, a kind of check towards that impulse that we can have towards just self-clinging and selfishness and not being that generous, so generous as a bodhisattva. But also I hear it as already assuming that the good part of that, inward turning, that desire to free ourselves, is already there. And so that doesn't have to be really mentioned so much because it's presumed that that's already there. But that what we may need to hear, what may need to be encouraged and nurtured from within us is that much more magnanimous, generous heart of the bodhisattva. You know, people often sometimes will say that, or ask, you know, if you practice, if you just do the practice, if you just meditate, if you open up your mind, if you realize yourself, then won't compassion naturally come forth? Inevitably, necessarily. I don't know. I mean, in a sense, if one is truly realized, then the answer would have to be yes, because they're not two, they're not separate. But in terms of actual practice and development and training and being a person, each of us being who we are, I think it needs to be necessarily, consciously and deliberately nurtured and developed and brought forth, which is why there are so many teachings and practices to do just that. Once the layered gates are shattered, any place is a place of tranquility. Once the mind becomes unattached to things, all things become pure. There are many times that the mind or our conditioning or, you know, when we talk about conditioning too, in our English vernacular, that, in a sense, we're talking about our socialization, how we are karmically formed by our every experience. Our people, our families, friends, teachers, neighborhoods, our culture and embedded cultures, all the various influences. We talk about conditioning, that's really what we mean. Condition, as you know, has a different particular meaning in Buddhism. But there are many ways of talking about that kind of karmic formation that is both individual and collaborative, and inner and outer, that flows through the gates of our senses, that takes place within our conscious and deeply within our beneath conscious mind, the alaya. And those gates, which are both the way that the world flows through, are also the gates that we can close to keep the world out. It's like that deep, ancient impulse to protect, to defend, to fortify, to fortress, to be watchful, to survive. To survive, above all things, to survive. Over Hosan, Jimon and I were having dinner, and we had cleaned some lettuce, and so there was some lettuce I was going to put in the compost. And at the Abbasi, we have a whole bunch of chipmunks too, but we also have a whole heap of rabbits. And so, and I had a very incredible rabbit growing up, kind of a famous rabbit, you might say, if you were in the know. And so I have a particular thing with rabbits. So I've really enjoyed having this families of rabbits. So I went out, there was a little young rabbit out in front of the house, right? We were sitting, eating and watching. And so I went out and it's stayed there because they've gotten used to it, so they don't necessarily run off. So I went out and I just tossed the lettuce close enough. And then I came back and we watched it. And this little bunny, you know, looked at it and then, you know, started moving towards it and then would sort of veer off and then it would come back. I mean, it really wanted that lettuce, but it was really taking its time. And I thought, yeah, it's being careful. It has been wired to be cautious and self-protective, to survive. Nobody wants to be hurt. Being hurt hurts, right? That's the way it works. And that's a device, right? It gets our attention. It tells us that there is something that is dangerous. And so then we develop a strategy, protection, ways of surviving, ways of of making it through that. And when that happens again and again and again, or in similar ways, those devices, those habits form, or those responses form into habits. And those habits become our attachments, right? Without our knowing, through their familiarity, we rely upon them. They become habitual, which means we don't have to think. We don't make a decision to respond in that way. We just respond. It's a reaction. And in that way, in that familiarity, it becomes part of us. It becomes a way we see ourselves. That's what we mean by identity. And again, it's not necessarily a conscious thing. I don't think of myself as someone who responds in this way. You know, we tend to think of identities as, you know, gender, race, you know, affinities, affiliations, things that we sort of consciously identify with. But in a sense, any familiar experience becomes part of an identity, something that we see as ourselves, something that we do, something that we are, a way we have of being in the world. And that identity then projects itself, moves outward. It becomes mind. And it's this that we practice. That's our practice. That quote of the teaching of Milarepa, that we're not so much meditating on something. We use things to meditate on as skillful means, as a way to develop all of what we need to develop and discover in Zazen. But really, he said, what we're doing is we're gaining familiarity with what has become so deeply familiar we don't see it. It's passed way beyond being familiar. It's not familiar. That's the thing. It has ceased to be familiar because it is so habitual. And even though it's so present, it's hidden. It's hidden from our conscious mind, from our real, our clear seeing mind. And that's why in the Zendo, or in any place where we sit, for those of you who are sitting at home, that we create a space that is safe enough that we can begin to allow ourselves to relax into seeing what is hard to see, but not safe in the sense that we will see what is hard to see. And that will feel unsafe at certain moments. It will feel dangerous. And we will be inclined to do what we've done, which is to protect ourselves. And so we're simultaneously stepping forward into what we perceive at different moments, and again, mostly not consciously, as somehow threatening. And freely, consciously, choosing to do that at the same time that we might be retreating. The layered gates ultimately shatter. That means they dissolve. We see that those constructions are just that. And within the dissolution of those habits is, we discover a place of tranquility. You know, I was saying to somebody earlier this week, we were talking about serenity. And I was saying, it's like when you look at the surface of a pond, right, or a lake, or any body of water, and it's perfectly still. I mean, I don't know how it is for you, but when I see that, there's something visceral that I experience. That is, it's like that part of us that yearns for that, recognizes. It's like there's a kinship. We see something that may not actually be familiar in our ordinary experience, but maybe is familiar in a much more ancient, primordial way. And we are drawn to that. And our attachments, in a way, are a kind of confused, upside-down attempt to find serenity, to find stability, to find a kind of peace. Right? When we live in a world that's chaotic, or a home, or we have relationships, or our internal world is chaotic, it makes sense that we would try to grab onto something and hold it, right? And sort of will it into serenity. But it just doesn't work like that. Buddha nature pervades the universe, existing here. It's always here. That's what she's saying. That's what Yukui is saying. Any place, every place now we realize is that tranquility. Even in the midst of turmoil. Because it's not dependent on outside. It's not something happening out there. And that, to really find that within turmoil, is one of the great challenges of practice. And it means we have to keep entering into turmoil. Which, you know, given the way the world works, is usually works out. It keeps showing up. But because in that we keep challenged, we keep being challenged, we keep practicing, we keep, in a sense, testing ourselves to discover where is that, not by holding on to it, but actually by not holding on to it. Once the mind becomes unattached to things, all things are now realized as pure. And so these images, the onion, right, peeling away the layers of the onion until you get to the core, which is just another layer. And you peel that away and there is no core. Or a hollow tree. The Buddha, I can't remember the name of the tree, if it was a plantain tree, some tree that he referred to a lot and used as an image because it was a tree, but when you cut it open, the inside was hollow, empty. Or a mirage on a hot day, when you see a mirage on the road, you're seeing water. But as you get closer, there's nothing there. An old master said, when the object of our grasping is transformed into the host, it no longer disturbs. When that which we have set outside of ourselves, which is causing the lack of serenity, the lack of peace, the lack of stability within ourselves, is transformed into your body and mind, it no longer disturbs. Any place is a place of tranquility. The offense is not in the thing. And that's also, you know, within the recognition that one of the forms of suffering comes from the outside. One of the forms of suffering is having things happen to us that causes pain. Of course, the experience of suffering itself is still within, but that it is being precipitated, brought about by something outside. And so Yukui says, now in moments of leisure, I sit upright in the shade of the pine tree, watching as the toad in the moon slowly rises to hover in the east. I guess there's a frog in the moon. Everybody sees something. Sitting upright in the shade of the pine tree. I mean, really, isn't that what we're seeking in our zazen? In part, is sitting upright in leisure, at ease. Dogen spoke of it as a Dharma gate of ease and joy. I remember the first time I heard that, I actually thought, shut up. It felt like a slap in the face. It felt so far away. Coming into alignment. Bringing ourselves into alignment. And we shouldn't underestimate the power, the wisdom of this sitting mudra. It's not just an efficient form. There is something inherent about this posture, this Buddha posture, that goes directly into our consciousness and knows, understands, without knowing, how to enter in. You know, it's so simple on the one hand, but if it's so simple, why is it so difficult? You're just sitting still. doing pretty much nothing. Why is it so difficult to sit in leisure, at ease, relaxed, and wakeful? What is that showing us? It's clearly showing us that that ease, that that wakefulness is not yet fully alive, manifest within the body. And what is the body? It's everything. It's your weight, it's gravity, it's heat, it's sensation, it's energy, it's intention. You know, it's interesting if thoughts were just thoughts, then when you had a thought, you would just hear or see the image of words, sounds that had meaning. It would be like, oh, just something passing in front of you. Ba 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 ba. And you would just sit there completely unaffected, right? Oh, something's passing by, words, right? But that's not what happened. It's like, oh, right? Those sounds, those abstract sounds that we give meaning to, they hook in. In a way, more and more I think of, having studied and reflected on and her teachings about ki and energy and all these different ways of talking about practice and realization. More and more I think of it as energy, which is a tricky way of speaking about it because energy is a word. It makes it sound, like something, like just another object. But then in a way, everything is energy. And it just manifests in different forms. It's like electricity. You can make toast. You can, boil water. You can kill somebody. It depends on how much of it you have and how you use it. We have energy within us. We are nothing but energy. Attachments, karmic obstructions are just sort of the misapplication, the tangling of energy. That's why practice is so difficult. That's why we get so worn down and tired and exhausted. It's not the things that we're doing. It's the energy that is not moving. It's not flowing. It's not free. And we experience it, we get caught, we feel caught in our body. Our minds get tangled, right? They can get so tight. And somebody is looking at you thinking, oh, they're peacefully sitting in meditation. Right? That's what it looks like from the outside. Inside, it can be like a war going on. And so to think about it that way, we can think about just letting go of thoughts as trying to find that calming, but we can also think of just calming that energy, soothing that energy, just relaxing in that upright posture of ease, and then the thoughts dissipate of their own. Watching the moon slowly rise to hover in the east. Shantideva spoke about that rising moon of the enlightened mind that soothes the sorrow born of the afflictions. I love that image, that rising moon of the enlightened mind that soothes the sorrow born of the afflictions. When one freely speaks of the Dharma, the heavenly flowers fall. When one deliberates and debates, one is only confused by things. So from the beginning, there's a clear understanding of the Dharma of how our mind seizes on words, seizes on language and meaning, and fixates, right? And turns towards that and becomes distant and blind from the object that the word is describing. And the Yogacara school, it goes much, much deeper in my sense of things. Sangha, who is one of the sort of principal teachers who brought forth Yogacara teachings, spoke about how, this is paraphrased, it's not his teaching, it's actually from a book by Bill Waldron, not yet published, where he spoke about how Sangha said that cognitive awareness, our knowing, arises due to the impressions of conventional expressions, words. These impressions of speech in our consciousness serve as a manifesting cause for objects to arise. Words, so we tend to think that an object appears and we name it. We describe it. And what he's saying is that the expression of language brings forth objects. For example, just the act of uttering the name I, E-Y-E, contributes to the arising of an I as an object in our awareness. Somebody says the word and then somebody says elephant and you see elephant in your mind. And so is this true for other expressions of dharmas, what we hear, what we taste, what we feel, and so on. In other words, Waldron says, the conventional expressions of our everyday speech, which delineate the world into discrete objects and categories, subtly condition, influence, create the way in which our awareness of those very things appears. So again, we think of our language as just narrating what's already happening. And what the Yogacara school is teaching, what we see, is that language is an active part of the creation. He says, in short, our sense of identity, which is so karmically potent, is not some simple referent of language, but a byproduct of the repetition that is language itself. How intimately connected speech is with our experience of the world, of everything. So then just reflecting on that and thinking about, okay, so if we're going to enter in and try and see into that and break free of that, kind of bondage, then we better let our speech come to rest. So letting go of thoughts is not just distractedness. It's not just to achieve a state of serenity. It's actually allowing the mind to experience things in and of themselves without language co-creating them. And of course, because language, we have history of it that goes back not just our lifetimes, but lifetimes. Kind of interesting. Which is why really as Dharma practitioners, you know, being in a Sangha, you know, we need to develop in skillfulness and ways to be in communication, to speak to each other. Right speech, loving words, respectful speech, honest, open speech. And at the same time, integrated with that is we need to also learn when not to speak. To recognize when speaking will change something. That's one of the reasons we ask students not to talk about what goes on in Doksan. Not just because it's your individual experience and what a teacher says to you may be very different than what a teacher says to somebody else and can cause confusion, but also because in speaking about it, even to ourselves, it changes the experience. With the right opportunity and good fortune, nothing is impossible, Yukui says. Knocking on emptiness, extracting the marrow becomes a way of life. And that's why it's important. You know, we're here and you're there, you're practicing. We've all encountered this Dharma. We're able to go to our cushions, take refuge there. We're able to practice within a Sangha, even at such a time as this. And with the help, a little help of technology, we're able to practice together as a Sangha. And in that way, because it seems so easy, that opportunity, that good fortune can get lost on us. We can think, well, of course. Can't everybody do that? No, actually. Everybody can't. It becomes a way of life. Isn't that what it's about? Everywhere, everything, each and every step. Turning within, stepping out. Practice is life. Mazumi Roshi used to say that over and over and over again. Practice your life. Practice is nothing but life. It's what we want. It seems so natural, and yet it's so difficult. Yukui says, how wonderfully sublime to discuss mysteries layered like clouds. It's rare to meet someone who can be called a kindred spirit. Indeed. So I was saying, we have, within a sangha, we have friends, Dharma friends, we have mentors, we have guides, we have those who provoke us, secret, undercover bodhisattvas, who are teaching us patience, acceptance, compassion, loving kindness, because they irritate us, teachers. And again, we might take that for granted. We might start thinking, they're not doing enough for us. Why aren't you doing more for me? Remember, we didn't come here to be taken care of. We came here to stand on our own 2 feet, to realize you are Buddha. You have it. Because we don't believe that, because we experience so many ways we feel insufficient, we look to be supported, we look to be carried a bit. And so we have to be attentive to that. Sangha is a treasure, but it is not actually a raft that carries you over. You're the raft. You build it out of your blood and sweat and tears. You build it out of your joy, your perseverance, your faith. And while you're building your raft, the person next to you is building theirs. It's a joint effort. It's good company. The way we take care of each other, and of course, we do take care of each other. And we learn how to do that. And part of learning how to do that is when to step forward and when to step back. When somebody falls, when to rush over and say, do you need a hand? And when to trust that they know how to stand. They're standing already. The red stove blazes forth with an extraordinary determination, as if possessed the karmic power to turn the Dharma wheel. This red stove, do you know what she's talking about? Is there blood running through your veins? Do you think you're going to live forever? Have you settled what you need to settle? When you hear the words, time swiftly passes by and opportunity lost, do you think, who are they talking to? Do you know who they're talking to? We need to remember this again and again. That's why we chant it all the time. That's why the teachings are reminding us all the time. Because it's passing swiftly and because we forget. And in a sense, the more established, the more sort of organized we become, in a certain way it gets easier, another way it gets harder. You know, in the early years, it was hard. There were things that were hard. And there's a value in that you have to keep asking yourself, why am I doing this? Why am I here? You have to keep remembering to be roused from our slumbering dream into an extraordinary determination to determine, to establish your path, your life. This is your life, right? It's happening. This is the one thing you have for now. It's the one thing I have for now. If I don't establish my path, it ain't going to happen. I mean, other people can direct my life and I can acquiesce, but that's not my path. That's just abdication. To establish, to settle the direction, that we want to be moving in, and then to walk that path, persevere step by step, day by day, year by year, to shatter the layered gates. This toiling life, disordered and confused by lust, greed, and anger, has it ever not been so? I mean, that is one thing we seem to share with all of humanity. You know, there's a story of a tribe of Maori indigenous people in New Zealand. I think it was New Zealand, who traveled. I told the story once because I read it when I was in New Zealand doing a session with the Sangha about this clan that traveled to an island off the coast of New Zealand and established themselves there and lived there. And they were utterly peaceful. They had no weaponry. They had no war. They had no language for war. They were utterly peaceful. They lived in harmony together. And I was presenting that as an example of, we can do that. After Sesshin, somebody came up and said, do you know what happened to them? I said, no. I presume they live happily ever after in peace and harmony. He said, no, they got wiped out by a clan with a different way of seeing things. So I tell you that sad story as a way of saying, it seems that this toiling life, disordered and confused by lust, greed, and anger, is something that has been passed down generation after generation after generation. And I think of each generation's time, ours, because we're in it, as our time to break that cycle, or at least put some serious shoulder into moving it in a new direction. Somebody was saying to me earlier that all of the pain and suffering that we see, all of the protesting and the reaching out and the demand for change, they perceived as a patient who is getting well, who is struggling to get well, is fighting for their own well-being and their health, seeing it as a good sign. This is a healthy thing, that these unattended to illnesses are being brought to the surface, recognized. I mean, they've always been on the surface, but seen by more and more who need to see them. The mind flower blooms and reveals the spring of enlightenment. The mind flower. What a beautiful image, the mind flower. Your mind is a flower that blossoms. Beautiful. And the world becomes spring. Spring is a way of speaking of enlightenment. Eternal spring. Any place is a place of tranquility. All so that we can have today. It's as simple and as profound as that. All of this for each of us to have today. And today. And today. And that's our gift and our inheritance to ourselves in each moment, each day, and to each other, and to generations. This life here and now is your Buddha field. The place in which you move and practice and, as Dada would say, combust your life and mingle. Mingle with the many creatures. Melting snow to boil water for tea, I while away the entire day. Just that. Just living her life, making tea, watching the sun move through the sky at ease, responding to the cries of the world, feeling inside as vast and expansive as the icy cold moon above. It's a little indulgent, but it needs to be said. Vast and expansive. So I'll request Yukui to have the last word. A tiny boat in the moonlight stirs up foam flowers on the water. Blossoming water lilies send across the fragrances in the dark. Hearing, seeing, knowledge, and consciousness are all one dharma, not two. Now, this nun can afford to be lazy and let her hair grow long. All of those many concerns and worries of yesterday now are seen through. Now, to enter into the scars of the burning. So, as we enter into our weekend of this session, those of you who have been practicing at home, and particularly those of you who have been working, because quite a number of you, I think, have been, maybe for the weekend you can put that aside. Your call as to whether you can do that or not. But I know that's what folks have been doing when they can, is to keep integrating with your lives as you've been going through your week, moving in and out of things, and then if it's possible to, towards the end of the week, to let it be more sort of seamless within sitting, silence, practicing together. So, but as before, you will work that out. And so, you know, this notion of just being lazy and letting the hair grow long. It's like when you hear a great musician play so effortlessly that it's as though there's no effort at all. And to know all that has gone into that effortlessness, all of the love and challenge and demanding and showing up over and over and over again, to step by step move into that place of naturalness. And so, sitting upright in the shade of the pine tree, trust this body and mind. Trust the body and mind of the Dharma.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page. Or scroll down and click on Retreats.